We would like to send out a special thanks to HelloFresh, America's number one meal kit, for sponsoring this episode. Go to HelloFresh.com/WentCold50 and use code WentCold50 for 50% off plus free shipping. Enjoy the episode. May 15th, 1981, East Chicago, Indiana. Jay Given, a 51-year-old attorney and political operative, attends a political fundraiser at the local Elks Club, but is fatally shot through the back of the head while exiting through the front doors. While a shell casing and a slug are collected from the crime scene and placed in an evidence drawer at the police station, it is later discovered to have been tampered with. The investigation turns towards the town's deputy police chief, John Cardona, who attended the fundraiser and had motive to kill Jay, but the authorities do not believe the evidence is strong enough to file charges, so Jay's murder is never solved. After that, the trail went cold. Hello, everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and today we're going to be exploring a cold case involving corruption and political intrigue, the 1981 murder of Jay Given. This story was once featured on Unsolved Mysteries, and I consider it to be one of the more underrated cases from the show, since it has never got a lot of discussion online. But it's certainly an unusual crime, because it involves a man being shot to death in the lobby of a building where a political fundraiser was taking place, but even though there were over 400 people there, none of them would admit to having witnessed the murder or seen the shooter. If that wasn't enough, the man most suspected of being the killer was the deputy chief of the local police department. Jay Given was one of the most prominent citizens in the town of East Chicago, Indiana, as he had previously been the city attorney, but was most known for his heavy influence on the political scene, which earned him the nickname the Midnight Mayor. In fact, the reason Jay was attending this fundraiser was to endorse a new candidate for mayor in the election, which may have paved the way for his death. Obviously, a man in Jay's position was going to have a lot of powerful enemies, and one of them was Deputy Police Chief John Cardona, who attended the fundraiser and would have been negatively impacted if Jay's new candidate was elected into power. After some key ballistics evidence was taken to the police station, it wound up being tampered with, and while a compelling circumstantial case against Cardona began to mount, the people in power ultimately felt that the evidence was not strong enough to indict him for murder and bring him to trial. There's always been speculation that there were eyewitnesses present at the scene who did not share everything they knew, and that a cover-up might have taken place to protect the killer. This is definitely a very frustrating and convoluted case, and should make for a very interesting episode. Anyway, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or a review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, including stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now delve into the murder of Jay Given. Our story begins in 1981 in East Chicago, Indiana, which is located in Lake County on the shores of Lake Michigan and is only about 18 miles southeast of Chicago, Illinois. East Chicago is considered to be a blue-collar town and home to the Indiana Harbor and Ship Canal, which connects the Great Calumet River to Lake Michigan, and the town had a population of around 39,000 people at that time. Our central figure is 51-year-old Jay Given, a lifelong resident of East Chicago who lives with his wife of 26 years, Phyllis Given, and has two sons named Jeff and David, and a daughter named Leslie. Jay works as a senior partner at the town's biggest law firm, Given, Dawson, and Kappus, and is considered to be one of East Chicago's most prominent citizens. From 1963 until 1974, he held the position of city attorney, but is best known for being a powerful political operative and fundraiser who has so much behind-the-scenes influence over the town's elections that he earned the nickname the Midnight Mayor. Jay's son Jeff described him as a man who was skilled at trading on favors to create strong political alliances, but he was also known for having a hot temper and making his fair share of enemies. Jeff stated, quote, "My father was intimately familiar with the politicians and people in power. He knew all the skeletons in their closets, and that makes you very powerful in a town like this." End quote. Jay played a major role in helping get East Chicago's current mayor, Robert Pastrick, elected to the position in 1970, but even though Jay was one of Pastrick's closest advisors and friends for years, the two men eventually had a falling out. Pastrick had appointed Jay to be the legal consultant on East Chicago's sanitary board, but some of the town's city councilmen had such a dislike for Jay that they refused to approve any of the mayor's projects while Jay was working under him. As a result, Pastrick removed Jay from the sanitary board, and another major breaking point in their relationship occurred in 1977 when sanitary district superintendent Joseph Rakowski was convicted of using $60,000 in city funds for the purchase of gifts for political rallies and fundraisers. When Rakowski went on trial, Pastrick testified that this practice was done with Jay Given's full support and authorization while he was serving as the city attorney. Jay's falling out with the mayor became so heated that he filed a pair of lawsuits against Pastrick and a number of other city councilmen for alleged violations of open meeting and records laws. By 1981, Jay was determined to have Pastrick removed from office and hoped to see another candidate take his place as mayor in the next election. He was planning to back N. Adderson Spann, the late county commissioner and the most prominent black politician in the area. On the evening of May 15th, a political fundraiser was being held for Spann at the local Elks Club building on Magoon Avenue, and while Jay ordinarily did not attend many fundraisers, he knew that a number of prominent city and county officials from the area would be there, and this was a good opportunity to work the room. Jay knew that the Hispanic American population in East Chicago were gaining a lot of political strength and planning to back Robert Pastrick in the next mayoral election. At the time, Hispanics comprised 40% of the population of East Chicago, whereas white and black citizens each comprised 30%, so Jay felt that attending a fundraiser for Spann would help solidify the white and black power blocks and increase Spann's chances of being elected. Jeff Given, who was 25 years old at this point, had recently returned home to his parents' apartment after completing his first year at Indiana University's law school, and he also began clerking at his father's firm. Jay obtained two tickets for Spann's fundraiser and wanted Jeff to attend with him, but since Jeff had already made plans that night, he declined. According to Jeff, this made his father angry, and when he left to go out, Jay was still refusing to speak with him. However, Jeff did not anticipate that this would be the last time he ever saw his father alive. At around 9:30 p.m., Jay arrived at the Elks Club building in order to attend the fundraiser, which was taking place on the second floor and attended by over 400 people. For the next hour and a half, Jay proceeded to mingle with Spann and the other attendees, but shortly after 11 o'clock, he told everyone that he needed to go because he and his wife were leaving on a trip to Cleveland the following morning. He then headed downstairs into the lobby and walked towards the front doors, but before he could leave the building, Jay would become the victim of a murder. At 11:15 p.m., the East Chicago Police Department received an emergency call that a man had just been shot at the Elks Club. When police arrived at the building, they discovered Jay's body lying face down in the vestibule between the lobby and the front doors. He had been shot once through the back of the head from several feet away, and Jay's car keys, lighter, and a cigarette he was presumably planning to smoke were lying on the floor next to him. Jay was immediately transported to St. Catherine Hospital, but he was pronounced dead shortly after he arrived. Robbery did not appear to be the motive for the crime, as Jay still had his wallet, credit cards, and wristwatch on him. And while attending the fundraiser, Jay had won $300 in a raffle, but all the cash was left behind in his pocket. When he originally arrived at the Elks Club, Jay had parked his Mercedes at a cleaner's down the street, but the right side of his vehicle was now damaged, as an unknown motorist had sideswiped it in an apparent hit-and-run. After the gunshot was heard, a number of people from the upstairs fundraiser flocked into the lobby, as well as the Jockey Club, a restaurant and lounge located on the first floor. Unfortunately, once they realized a murder had taken place, a number of these people panicked and ran outside through the front doors. Since they went through the vestibule and passed over Jay's body, they wound up trampling over the crime scene and tracking blood everywhere and may have compromised potential evidence. When the police started conducting interviews, they could not find any witnesses who would admit to having seen Jay's murder or the individual who shot him. There were a couple of motorists and pedestrians outside the Elks Club building who reported hearing the gunshot, but none of them recalled seeing anyone exiting the building immediately after the shot took place. The most promising eyewitness was a firefighter named Mark Warholik, who attended the fundraiser. Sometime after 11 p.m., Warholik claimed that he left the event and walked downstairs to visit the bar at the Jockey Club. After spending a few minutes there, Warholik said that he left the club and walked across the lobby to the washroom and noticed Jay having a discussion with a man next to the vestibule. Shortly after entering the washroom, Warholik heard a gunshot and went back into the lobby to discover Jay's body lying on the floor in the vestibule, but the other man was now gone. Warholik described this man as being 6'1", having black wavy hair, and wearing a bluish-gray suit. The Given family were informed about Jay's murder, but the following day, they experienced additional trauma when someone fired a bullet through the living room window of their second-floor apartment. The Givens would later receive anonymous calls from a man who claimed to know the identity of Jay's killer. He said he would only reveal this information to Jay's wife Phyllis, but this did not occur, and the caller was never identified. Of course, Jay's death would lead to his lawsuits against Mayor Pastrick and the East Chicago City Council being dismissed. A shell casing from the murder weapon was found in the vestibule next to Jay's body, and the slug from the bullet would soon be recovered. As it entered the back of Jay's skull, exited through his forehead, passed through one of the glass front doors, traveled 63 feet across the street, and hit a brick building before it bounced back down onto the pavement. Aside from the damaged nose on the projectile, the slug was described as being in remarkably good condition and was collected by Inspector Paul DeChera of the East Chicago PD. DeChera put the slug and the shell casing in a bag and marked them as evidence before taking them back to the police station. However, even though it was standard practice to check these items into the station's evidence vault, DeChera decided to lock the slug and the shell casing inside a desk drawer in the crime lab, as he said he wanted to show it to some of the other investigators. DeChera soon mailed the evidence to the FBI crime lab in Washington, D.C. for analysis, but 2 weeks later, they informed him that the items had been tampered with. Someone had punched through the primer of the shell casing and then used a sharp instrument to cut the lines and grooves on the projectile in what seemed like an attempt to prevent them from being matched to a specific gun. Since the door to the East Chicago Police Station's crime lab was always kept locked, only about 8 people, including police officers and maintenance personnel, would have had the keys to access it. While the evidence had been inside a locked drawer, the keys to it were kept in an unlocked drawer on the same desk, though DeChera claimed he was unaware of this. The whole situation caused fear that Jay's murder was an inside job and that a cover-up was being orchestrated to protect the perpetrator. As a result, East Chicago Police Chief Stephen Robert Stiglich turned the investigation over to the Indiana State Police and the Lake County Metro Squad, which was comprised of homicide detectives from many different departments. The FBI were even allowed to become involved in the investigation since the evidence tampering constituted a federal civil rights violation. In spite of the tampering, the FBI still managed to match the casing to a specific weapon, a .45 caliber Detonix 1911-style Combat Master handgun. This particular firearm was quite rare, and the identification was made possible because there were only 58 existing Detonix guns in circulation, which had a specially modified ejecting mechanism for the casing that was found. Well, it turned out that one of these guns could be traced back to 36-year-old John Cardona, the East Chicago Deputy Police Chief. Cardona was questioned about this and admitted to owning such a firearm, but said that his gun had been stolen from his truck 6 months before the murder. However, while police records did confirm that Cardona reported a gun stolen during this time period, it was listed as being a revolver, not a Detonix firearm. When DeChera confronted Cardona about this discrepancy, he changed his story and said that he must have sold the gun instead. While Cardona was one of the few people who had access to the drawer containing the evidence, and one police officer would tell investigators that after Jay's murder took place, Cardona asked him questions about how a bullet or a casing could be traced back to a specific gun. The officer said he told Cardona that every bullet had two specific variables, and these same variables just happened to be the only markings which were tampered with on the slug which passed through Jay. It also turned out that Cardona had been attending the fundraiser at the Elks Club on the night Jay was killed. Cardona was an active member of the 2020 Club, a local Latino political group, but since they were supporting Robert Pastrick's re-election for mayor, they were not welcome at H. Adderson Spann's fundraiser. Cardona apparently gave conflicting accounts about why he was there, as he told some people that he noticed a car parked outside the Elk Club building, which belonged to a fellow police officer, so he decided to go inside to speak with him. However, others claim that Cardona told them he specifically went to the fundraiser to function as a political spy and keep an eye on Jay, since the 2020 Club was at odds with him. Jay had reportedly told people that if Spann was elected mayor, Cardona would be, quote-unquote, walking the beat again. And there was one witness who said that Cardona appeared to be following and shadowing Jay at the fundraiser. Cardona's alibi was that he was still at the fundraiser on the second floor, hanging out at the bar, when he heard the gunshot, and then ran downstairs to discover Jay's body. Many officers from the East Chicago PD confirmed that Cardona was in the lobby when they first arrived, and saw him take command of the scene. However, no other witnesses could corroborate Cardona's whereabouts during the time period Jay was killed, as some other people who knew Cardona personally claimed that he had been sitting at the bar when the shot was fired, but did not recall seeing Cardona there. As you recall, Mark Warholik had seen a man conversing with Jay in the lobby right before he was killed, but while his description of the man and his clothing seemed to be consistent with Cardona and what he was wearing that night, Warholik was unable to make a positive identification. Warholik did have an odd encounter with Cardona after the murder took place, as Cardona offered to personally drive him to the police station in order to make a statement, but before they arrived, they made a stop at St. Catherine Hospital, where Jay had just been taken. In their respective statements, both Cardona and Warholik claimed it was the other person's idea to stop there, but never provided an explanation why. By the spring of 1982, the case was still not resolved, so Lake County prosecuting attorney Jack Crawford brought in a private attorney from Hammond named Joseph Van Boekelen and appointed him to be special deputy prosecutor on the case. Around the same time, a special grand jury investigation was launched containing testimony from hundreds of eyewitnesses. However, Van Boekelen got the sense that certain witnesses were not sharing everything they knew, possibly out of fear for their lives. One of them was a woman who had worked as a dishwasher at the Jockey Club, which was located several feet away from the spot where Jay was killed. Whenever her shift ended, it was common practice for her to wait on a bench in the lobby for a ride, yet on the night the murder took place, she said she left the building at 10:30 p.m. in order to walk home because she, quote-unquote, heard a voice in her head telling her to do so. Investigators got the sense that the witness was not being entirely truthful and may have seen something related to the murder. She made statements that she, quote-unquote, just wanted to forget that entire night, and said that if a high-profile figure like Jay Given could be killed, how could the authorities protect a nobody like her? There was another witness named Odessa Gamble who refused to cooperate and testify in front of the grand jury. According to Gamble, after she spoke to investigators and shared statements another person had made to her in regards to Jay's murder, both she and her children have been threatened and harassed by members of the police. Even though Gamble was informed that she would serve 10 days in jail for contempt of court if she did not cooperate, she still opted to accept that punishment rather than testify, stating she would, quote-unquote, serve the time if that is what they choose to do, play games with my life. There were other eyewitnesses who seemed to provide important information, but then turned out to have credibility issues. For instance, a gunsmith at a Detonix factory claimed he had repaired Cardona's Detonix handgun and was certain that the shell casing from the crime scene originated from this weapon. But upon further investigation, It turned out this gunsmith had never actually done repairs on Cardona's gun at any point. In the weeks following the murder, the Indiana State Police and the Lake County Metro Squad asked everyone from the East Chicago PD to take a polygraph, but Cardona was the only one who wound up failing. 2 years later, Cardona was asked to take a second polygraph while being questioned about the murder and the evidence tampering, but he refused to do so. Shortly thereafter, in August of 1983, after Chief Stiglich brought upon two disciplinary charges against him, Cardona was found guilty of the charges and dismissed from the East Chicago PD by the East Chicago Board of Safety. These charges included Cardona's refusal to take the second polygraph, as well as an incident from the summer of 1978 where Cardona had confiscated a .45 caliber automatic pistol while on duty and subsequently sold it. The grand jury investigation would last 2 years, and by November of 1984, Joseph Van Buchelen publicly announced that he believed they were close to an indictment and that it would likely occur within the next 4 months. However, this indictment never took place. Van Buchelen would later say that he felt the circumstantial evidence against Cardona was strong enough for an indictment, but Lake County prosecuting attorney Jack Crawford and members of his prosecutor's task force disagreed. Crawford told Van Buchelen that since Jay's murder and the evidence tampering had brought so much adverse publicity to Lake County, he felt he could not afford to lose the case and was reluctant to bring Cardona to trial unless the evidence against him was airtight. Crawford expressed his belief that while the evidence was strong enough to charge Cardona with murder, he was not so sure he could secure a conviction from a jury. After the grand jury investigation came to a close, the case would return to the spotlight 2 years later, when a witness named Chester Newsom came forward, claiming that he had been outside the Elks Club building on the night of the murder. Newsom said that he looked through the glass front doors and saw Jay and Cardona arguing and shoving each other in the lobby before he heard a gunshot just seconds later. However, the issue was that Newsom was a convicted felon facing a lengthy prison term and was sharing information in hopes of cutting a deal for himself. While it turned out that Newsom had been present outside the Elks Club that night, he admitted that he was only there to steal cars and never actually saw Cardona. Another interesting development took place in December of 1986 when Van Buchelen announced that the investigation would be reopened because of some new developments involving Paul DeChara. DeChara had since relocated to Georgia, and when he testified in front of the grand jury 3 years earlier, he claimed to have no idea that the slug and the shell casing had been tampered with and did not realize this had occurred until after he sent the evidence to the FBI. But DeChara was now changing his story and told investigators that he noticed the tampering had occurred 5 days after the murder. DeChara said that he lied about this because he feared the authorities were going to make him a scapegoat and he could not afford to lose his job because he was a widower with 5 kids to support. In March of 1987, DeChara was indicted on the charges of perjury and false informing, but when he agreed to plead guilty to the charges 4 months later, he received a sentence of probation. Once again, the case faded from the spotlight, but it would receive national exposure when it was featured on an episode of Unsolved Mysteries, which aired in January of 1994. One of the primary goals of the segment was to identify a trio of witnesses who had attended the fundraiser at the Elks Club. Right before the shooting took place, a total of 5 people were heading down the stairs into the lobby, and while 2 of them were identified and questioned, the other 3 were not, and presumably left the building before the police arrived. The first 2 witnesses said they had been walking behind 3 black males, but did not personally witness the murder. However, they said the 3 males were at the foot of the stairs at the moment the shot was fired, so investigators wondered if they might have caught a glimpse of the killer. They hoped that at least one of these men might watch the Unsolved Mysteries segment and come forward to share what they knew, but none of them ever did. As for John Cardona, he had since relocated to Florida, and when Unsolved Mysteries contacted him about doing an on-camera interview, he declined and continued to maintain his innocence by stating, quote, "I didn't do anything wrong." Over the next 3 decades, the Times of Northwest Indiana newspaper would publish a number of articles about the crime, which often contained interviews with Jeff Given, who was still seeking answers about his father's murder. In an article published in December of 2009, it was revealed that investigators were still hoping to speak with the dishwasher who had been working at the Jockey Club on the night of the crime, as they felt she might hold key information. The Times was able to locate the witness's daughter, who said that she was now 80 years old and living in a nursing home in Texas, but still did not want to talk about the case for fear of her own safety. The Times would always seek out John Cardona for comment whenever these articles were published, but he never returned their phone calls, and things eventually reached the point where they were unable to locate him. Cardona's current whereabouts are unknown, and I'm not even sure if he is still alive. Tragically, Phyllis Given passed away in July of 2009 at the age of 77, without receiving any answers about her husband's death. The investigation is still in a holding pattern, and after 4 decades, the murder of Jay Given continues to remain unsolved. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. But before we continue, we would like to send out a special thanks to HelloFresh for supporting The Trail Went Cold. From chef-crafted seasonal recipes to their fresh and fit summer menu, HelloFresh brings flavor right to your door. Go to HelloFresh.com/WentCold50 and use code WentCold50 for 50% off plus free shipping. We're almost near the end of July right now, but I really can't think of a better way to take a bite out of summer than with HelloFresh. It's actually a peak time for summer produce, and the ingredients with every HelloFresh meal are delivered from the farm to your door in less than 7 days, which ensures a better quality that you can taste. In fact, HelloFresh allows you to get the best picks all season long and offers a lot more than just delicious dinners. Remember, it's summertime and the weather is nice and there's so much to do, so you don't want to spend a bunch of your free time making an extra run to the grocery store. Instead, just simply shop at the HelloFresh market, as you will be able to add snacks, sides, and more to your weekly orders, and take your pick from a curated selection of over 100 items. One of my most recent HelloFresh meals was the chicken souvlaki dinner plate, which was also accompanied by dill rice and feta sauce, as well as some fresh produce which was used to make a nice salad consisting of spring mix, lemon, Roma tomatoes, and mini cucumbers. Not only was the meal delicious, but it was also so convenient as well, as after it was delivered to my door, I was able to prepare it in only 25 minutes. Once preparation is that easy, you never have to utter the dreaded phrase, I guess you could say, the meal went cold. So once again, go to HelloFresh.com/WentCold50 and use code WentCold50 for 50% off plus free shipping. That's HelloFresh.com/WentCold50 and the promo code is also WentCold50. Thank you and enjoy the rest of this episode. I've covered hundreds of cold cases on The Trail Went Cold, and while some of them are completely perplexing, there are others which make me cry out, how in the world has this not been solved? The murder of Jay Given would definitely rank near the top of that list, because he was shot inside the lobby of a building in close proximity to over 400 potential witnesses, yet no one there saw the crime or was able to identify the killer. While there is a very compelling circumstantial case against the prime suspect, John Cardona, certain people in power have just never felt the evidence was strong enough to file murder charges. On one hand, I can kind of understand their logic, because if Cardona was the perpetrator, then this would definitely rank as one of the most brazen murders ever committed. And if Cardona went on trial, his attorneys could potentially point to some of his actions and use the, "Do you really think my client would be stupid enough to do this?" defense. This is why the Lake County Prosecutor's Office were reluctant to make an indictment without some sort of smoking gun, such as an eyewitness who could directly place Cardona at the murder scene. Given the stakes surrounding this case, as well as the politics involved, it sounds like the prosecution wanted to be 100% certain they could get a conviction before they took Cardona to trial. But on the other hand, it's also possible that Cardona was never indicted because certain people in power did not want this case to be solved, either because they had a personal dislike for Jay Given, or they were worried that a high-profile murder trial might bring some of the other dark secrets and corruption in the town to the surface. Jay was described as someone who knew all the skeletons in everybody's closet, but given that he was the deputy police chief, it's possible that Cardona had some dirt on people as well, and if he went down, he would not hesitate to take others with him. While this is certainly not the most mysterious case to be covered on this podcast, it's definitely one of the more fascinating because of all the political intrigue. I previously mentioned that East Chicago, Indiana is located about 18 miles outside Chicago, Illinois, but even though it only had a fraction of Chicago's population, it seemed like it had just as many issues with corruption. For the past four decades, Jeff Given has always been a major advocate for solving this case and keeping it in the spotlight. Jeff would be the first person to admit that his father was not a saint and could rub people the wrong way with his hot temper. I'm sure it still haunts Jeff that his final memory of Jay was seeing him get angry and refuse to speak to him because he declined his offer to accompany his father to the fundraiser at the Elks Club. If Jeff had gone to the fundraiser, perhaps he would have been shot too, but it's also possible that the killer might have been more reluctant to go through with it if Jay was in the company of his son. Jeff has never hesitated to express his belief that John Cardona killed his father and finds it frustrating that no charges were ever filed against him. Even though the case against Cardona was circumstantial, Jeff felt the authorities should have at least taken Cardona to trial and let a jury decide. If they found him not guilty, then investigators could try to find out who really committed this crime. But obviously, due to the political climate in East Chicago at that time, things were not that simple. Before his father was killed, Jeff seemed eager to follow in his footsteps since he was attending law school and clerking at Jay's firm. But when he was interviewed for an article about the case published in 1994, Jeff revealed that he decided to abandon his career as a litigation attorney and was now running a company that sold promotional products such as personalized computer accessories. He stated, quote, "Very few people in politics in East Chicago seem to be very concerned with public service. I may not make as much money as I would have had I been in politics in East Chicago, but I'm happier. I can look myself in the face." End quote. I think Jeff perfectly summed up the political climate in East Chicago and Lake County in general when he made this remark, quote, "The thing is, in Lake County, you really don't have any check or balance system. In Lake County, checks and balances amount to, I've got something on you and you've got something on me, so let's get along and go along," end quote. It seems obvious that Jay Given had a lot of potential blackmail material on powerful people in Lake County and would not hesitate to use that in order to get what he wanted. However, while this certainly made Jay a number of enemies who wanted to bring him down, he was never actually charged with any crime. As an example, in 1976, Jay was implicated in a bribery scandal when Ben Lesniak, the director of the East Chicago Housing Authority, was indicted and convicted of accepting bribes from construction contractors. While Lesniak accused Jay and other city officials of also accepting bribe money during the scam, there was no evidence to prove his allegations. I suppose it will remain up for debate whether Jay legitimately kept his nose clean or if he just knew how to work the system to keep out of trouble, but it's crazy to see just how many prominent figures from East Chicago during that time period would wind up finding themselves in legal trouble. For instance, let's start with the mayor of East Chicago, Robert Pastrick, who once had Jay as a close friend and advisor until they had a major falling out. Even though Jay made an effort to have Pastrick ousted from office, he would remain mayor for a total of 33 years. But in 2009, Pastrick found himself at the center of a RICO case when he and other city officials were implicated in a Sidewalks for Vote scheme. The scheme occurred when Pastrick was seeking re-election in 1999, and these officials allegedly squandered $24 million in taxpayer funds on a sidewalk paving and tree trimming operation, which did not serve any purpose besides allowing Pastrick to curry favor with voters. As a result of this investigation, the Indiana Attorney General issued a judgment of $108 million in civil damages against Pastrick and his co-defendants, which marked the first time a U.S. city administration was found to be a criminal enterprise under federal racketeering laws. 4 years later, after the state collected over $331,000 from the defendants, the Indiana Attorney General gave the funds back to the city of East Chicago. The scandal did harm to Pastrick's reputation, and he would pass away in October of 2016. As you recall, at the time of his murder, Jay Given was endorsing Ann Adderson Spann to beat Pastrick in the next mayoral election, but Spann wound up becoming a problematic figure as well. By the end of the 1980s, Spann was convicted on various state and federal charges for such crimes as racketeering, bribery, and conspiracy. He received a 20-year prison sentence, though he was released after serving only six of them, and Spann died just last year, in May of 2022. So even though John Cardona was the deputy police chief of East Chicago, it does not sound like the police chief, Stephen Robert Stiglitch, was willing to cover for him, since he enlisted the help of a number of outside agencies to handle the investigation into Jay's murder. However, this may have been due to a conflict of interest, because 1 year earlier, Stiglitch had been involved in his own scandal when he was charged with vote buying during a primary election for Lake County Sheriff. And guess who was called upon to be Stiglitch's defense attorney? Jay Given. Stiglitch ultimately agreed to plead guilty to the charge in exchange for a sentence of probation, and since he still got to hold on to his job as police chief and wound up becoming Lake County Sheriff a few years later, it really doesn't seem like he suffered any real consequences for his actions. And there's also the perjury charge which was leveled against Inspector Paul DeChara, who was responsible for locking up the slug and shell casing inside an evidence drawer before it was tampered with. It sounds like the authorities cleared DeChara of any involvement in the actual tampering, as he claimed he only lied about certain details because he feared he would lose his job. However, some sources out there have stated that DeChara lied in order to protect John Cardona from a potential evidence tampering charge. As if this story wasn't colorful enough, when DeChara was interviewed on Unsolved Mysteries, he appeared on camera sporting a patch over his right eye, though I was unable to find out the circumstances of how he lost his eye to begin with. But when you see how many of the authority figures in this case seem to have their hands dirty with something, it's no wonder this case was never solved. So now I'm going to take a few moments to talk about another unsolved murder which took place in East Chicago only a year and a half before Jay was killed. On December the 12th, 1979, 49-year-old Henry Babe Lopez, who was the East Chicago Park Superintendent and a former President and Financial Secretary for the United States Steelworkers of America, Local 1010, vanished without a trace. Lopez's city-owned Oldsmobile also vanished with him, and prior to his disappearance, he told a friend he had received a threatening phone call. Well, on January the 29th, 1980, the Oldsmobile was discovered in the Grand Calumet River. Lopez's body was in the driver's seat, and he had been shot execution style with a single bullet wound to the back of his head, and a brick was used to hold down the accelerator and drive the car into the river. On the day he went missing, Mayor Robert Pastrick had suspended Lopez from his job because he was refusing to answer questions from the Indiana State Board of Accounts about an audit which showed that over $9,500 in park department funds were missing. There was speculation that Lopez may have been murdered over his political activities, as prior to his disappearance, he told people that he, quote-unquote, wasn't going to go down alone. After a homicide investigation was launched, a notorious mob executioner named Edelmiro Corfi de Jesus was looked at as a potential suspect, but de Jesus himself became the victim of an execution-style murder on May the 27th, 1980. It's been theorized that De Jesus was killed because he had been bragging about Lopez's murder, but even if he was the shooter, investigators have always believed that more than one person was involved in the crime. On the day Lopez went missing, he told his wife he was planning to meet with Vince Kieran, a corporate businessman and backroom politician whom Lopez felt would intercede on his behalf with city officials. One source told police that prior to his own murder, De Jesus had said Kieran hired him to kill Lopez. Since Kieran was an influential figure who was friends with a number of East Chicago's most prominent citizens, all attempts to pursue a grand jury investigation against him for Lopez's murder went nowhere. Years later, Kieran was indicted on the charges of conspiracy and mail fraud during a federal investigation into corruption in Lake County and spent time in prison before he died in 1998. Now, I see no reason to believe that the murders of Babe Lopez and Jay Given are connected, but it is interesting that the link between these two men is their involvement with Mayor Robert Pastrick. Given how Lopez was killed around the time he was being investigated for embezzlement, this should drive home the point of how much rampant corruption there was in East Chicago during this time period. And most importantly, I think this paints a picture of why so many potentially important eyewitnesses in the Jay Given murder may have kept their mouths shut about key information. It seems like their faith in law enforcement and public officials was so shaken by this point that they felt their lives would be in danger if they went on the record and shared everything they knew. I know that the Given family received a couple of calls from an anonymous man who said he knew the identity of Jay's killer and would only share this information with Phyllis. This may have been nothing more than a prank, but it's also possible that the caller did legitimately know something and did not feel they could trust anyone outside the Given family. And we have one witness, Odessa Gamble, who was willing to spend 10 days in jail for contempt of court rather than testify in front of a grand jury, which is a surefire sign of a major systemic problem in the area. Given the circumstances, it's easy to assume that Jay Given was the victim of a professional hit, but if that's the case, I don't see why the responsible party would do it in a public place where there were 400 potential witnesses around. Why not wait until Jay has stepped outside and shoot him there? Or pull a Babe Lopez and kill Jay while he's inside his car and then run the vehicle into the Grand Calumet River? This is why I think there's a good chance that Jay's murder was a crime of passion done in the heat of the moment, and the shooter just got incredibly lucky that they managed to get away with it. Phyllis Given was once asked if she believed her husband's murder was a conspiracy, and she replied that she felt it was, quote-unquote, a little bit of both, which was part conspiracy and part spontaneous confrontation. In other words, the murder itself may have been a spontaneous, unplanned event, but there was still a conspiracy to ensure that the perpetrator would never be arrested or stand trial. Now, I'll state right up front that it's very difficult to come up with a scenario that does not involve John Cardona being involved in the murder, because for him to be completely innocent, that would require a hell of a lot of coincidences. Right from the outset, there was suspicion against Cardona because there was no reason for him to have even attended the fundraiser at the Elks Club to begin with. He was an active member of the 2020 Club who were planning to endorse Robert Pastrick's re-election for mayor, so obviously, no one from that club would be welcome at a fundraiser for Pastrick's opponent, Ann Addison Spann. Cardona reportedly gave conflicting stories about why he was there, as he told some people that he was just passing through the area and saw a car parked outside, which belonged to another police officer he knew, so he decided to go inside to see him. However, I'm not sure if investigators ever confirmed if this police officer was actually at the fundraiser or if he spoke to Cardona that night. It seems like Cardona did admit to other people that a specific reason for attending the fundraiser was to shadow Jay, because if he managed to help Spann get elected mayor, Jay was probably going to use his influence to ensure Cardona lost his job as deputy police chief. Cardona definitely had a motive to kill Jay, but once again, why shoot him in the lobby within earshot of so many eyewitnesses? Remember, these witnesses were not just on the second floor attending the fundraiser. About 100 of them were on the first floor in the jockey club next to the lobby, and they were able to flock out there within seconds of hearing the gunshot. We also have the eyewitness account from Mark Warholik, who said he saw Jay speaking with another man next to the vestibule right before he was killed. If this man was Cardona, it's possible Jay said something which put him into such a fit of rage that he pulled out his gun and shot Jay in the back of the head when he turned around to exit the building. I have no idea what Jay could have said to Cardona to draw such a violent reaction, but one reason I'm inclined to believe the crime was not premeditated was that the murder weapon was a very rare .45 caliber Detonix handgun. Yes, the gun was never found, but if Cardona had planned on killing Jay, I have to think he would use a much more common handgun which could not be traced back to him so easily. After all, as a police officer, Cardona would have had the means and the access to obtain an untraceable weapon. An alternate theory I've seen pushed forward is that Cardona was not the actual shooter, but instead went to the trouble of speaking with Jay in the lobby and distracting him so that someone else could shoot him in the back of the head. But if so, why would Cardona provide the shooter with his own handgun, which was so rare it could be traced back to him? If the shooting was the result of a spontaneous confrontation, then it makes more sense that Cardona would use this gun if he just happened to be carrying it on him at that moment. While killing Jay in a public place was an incredibly risky thing to do, going into the evidence drawer at the police station to tamper with the slug and the casing was even riskier. I'm sure Cardona was well aware that only a handful of people, including himself, had access to that drawer, meaning he would automatically come under a cloud of suspicion. I don't think he would have gone to this trouble if he had used a more common or untraceable handgun, but I'm sure Cardona was paranoid that since this firearm was very rare, it could be linked to him, so he felt that the evidence tampering was worth the risk. The fact that Cardona gave conflicting stories about what happened to the Detonics gun once it was traced back to him is incredibly suspicious. Now, even though I've harped on how risky it was for the killer to shoot Jay in such a public place, the one thing which did work in their favor is that the large number of people in the building caused enough chaos to make it very difficult to properly secure the crime scene and get a handle on what happened. Remember, when they heard the gunshot and saw Jay lying in the vestibule, a lot of these people panicked and ran out the front doors over his body, which may have compromised potential evidence. And this chaos may have allowed the perpetrator to fade into the background, making it more difficult for them to be positively identified as the shooter. There were a number of witnesses on the street outside the Elks Club building who remembered hearing a gunshot, but none of them reported seeing anyone running out the front doors immediately after the shot was fired. If the killer managed to stay hidden for a few moments, they could have blended in with the rest of the crowd and ran outside along with them without anybody noticing. One crazy detail is that another vehicle sideswiped and damaged Jay's parked car in a hit and run, but since there was so much chaos and so many people fleeing the scene, this could have been done by a completely random motorist rather than the killer. However, what's strange about this whole situation is that Mark Warholik said he was inside the washroom when he heard the shot, and when he ran out into the lobby and saw Jay's body, no one else was there. Granted, I'm not completely familiar with the layout of the lobby in this building, but after firing the shot, could the killer have found somewhere to hide in a very narrow window of time? I guess it's possible they could have ducked into the ladies' room or something, which is why Warholik didn't see them. What we do know is that when police arrived at the building, multiple officers confirmed that John Cardona was already there and took command of the scene. This on its own is not suspicious, since Cardona attended the fundraiser, so it's only natural that he would want to handle a murder which took place in his presence. But the problem is that no one was able to account for Cardona's whereabouts at the precise moment Jay was shot. He only said that he was hanging out at the bar on the second floor, but there were other people there at that moment who knew Cardona personally, but could not recall seeing him at the bar. So theoretically, if Cardona is lying and was the shooter, he could have hidden somewhere for a few moments and only reemerged when a crowd of people flocked down into the lobby and he was less likely to be noticed. He then announces his presence by stating he's a police officer and is taking command of the murder scene, which also gives off the outward impression that he wants the crime to be solved. This is what we would call, if I did this, would I really be stupid enough to hang around the murder scene defense? And I'm sure Cardona's attorneys would have used it if he went on trial. Of course, one of the biggest obstacles against making a case against Cardona was finding someone who could actually place him at the murder scene at the time Jay was shot. Believe it or not, the person who called the police to report the shooting at 11:14 p.m. was never actually identified. The caller was a woman who spoke with a Spanish accent, but since the dispatcher mistakenly hung up without taking her name, police never got the chance to formally question her. It's been theorized that the woman was not actually at the Elks Club and may have made the call from an apartment building across the street after hearing the gunshot and looking out the window, but if she had been questioned about what she saw, it's possible she may have been able to provide additional information which benefited the investigation. The Unsolved Mysteries segment put emphasis on a trio of black men who were apparently at the foot of the stairs in the lobby when the shooting took place, so they may have caught a glimpse of the killer. It seems very likely these men left the building before the police arrived, and while they may have been completely unaware that investigators even wanted to question them, it's also possible they made the calculated decision not to come forward and get involved for fear of their own lives, which is a recurring theme in this case. The two other witnesses from that night, who may have seen more than they let on, were Mark Warholik and an unnamed female dishwasher who worked at the Jockey Club. I mentioned earlier that when the Times of Northwest Indiana attempted to track this woman down in 2009, they spoke to her daughter, who revealed that her mother was now 80 years old and living in a nursing home. There's a good chance this woman has passed away by now, but even at that age, it seems she still feared that speaking about that night would put her life at risk. Even though it was her ordinary routine to wait for a ride in the Elks Club lobby when her shift ended, on this particular night, she decided to leave early and walk home and was conveniently absent when Jay's murder took place. I mean, it is possible she was telling the truth, but whenever investigators spoke with this woman, she apparently gave off the vibe that she was afraid and not sharing everything she knew. So could it be possible that she got a good look at the individual who committed this crime and could positively identify them? Well, if that's the case, and she had decided to go on the record as a witness, it sounds like she had no faith that the authorities could protect her. And the fact that she still apparently felt that way 38 years later, while living in an entirely different state, really seems to say a lot about the culture of fear in East Chicago in 1981. Of course, the most important witness in this whole affair was Mark Warholik, since he saw Jay conversing with another man right before his death, but could not identify him as John Cardona. From what I can tell, Warholik didn't flat out say that the man was not Cardona, as he may have just simply not gotten a good enough look at him to make a positive identification. After all, Warholik only mentioned the man's height and his hair color, but nothing about his facial features, so it's possible he only saw him from behind, though Warholik's description of the man's clothing was consistent with what Cardona had been wearing that night. I guess an alternate explanation is that the man may have just been a random innocent bystander that Jay stopped to chat with, and this guy left the building before Cardona or someone else showed up and shot Jay in the back of the head. However, the big red flag is that when Cardona drove Warholik to the police station to make a statement, they decided to take a detour and stop at St. Catherine Hospital, where Jay had just been taken. Even though Jay was mortally wounded, he was not officially pronounced dead until he arrived at the hospital, so if Cardona was the shooter, he may have wanted to confirm that Jay was not going to survive and identify him. Alternatively, the innocent explanation is that Cardona may have been concerned about Jay's well-being and just wanted to check on his condition, but the problem is that he never actually said this, as Warholik claimed that Cardona didn't provide any explanation for why they stopped by the hospital. And Cardona told investigators that it was Warholik's idea to go there, even though Warholik would have no logical reason to do so. I get the sense that Cardona may have wanted to take a ride with Warholik in order to pick his brain and find out what he did or did not see. Now, the authorities have never publicly accused Warholik of lying or not sharing everything he knows, but after being questioned by police a few times and testifying in front of the grand jury, Warholik hired an attorney and moved to Florida. And when the Times of Northwest Indiana attempted to speak with Warholik for their article in December of 2009, he declined the request to comment. If Cardona was the shooter, I still question whether he would have had enough time to disappear and hide in the seconds it took for Warholik to exit the washroom into the lobby after hearing the gunshot. But even if Warholik couldn't place Cardona at the murder scene, if he told investigators that he had seen Cardona conversing with Jay in the lobby, that still would have contradicted Cardona's story about being upstairs at the bar when the shooting took place. So I have to wonder if Cardona may have said or did something to Warholik during the ride to the police station, such as offered him a payoff or threatened his life, which prevented Warholik from making a positive identification. I certainly don't want to accuse Warholik of perjury, as he may very well have been telling the full truth, but it's still mind-boggling to me that the shooting could have taken place in a building filled with 400 people and not one of them saw the perpetrator. I definitely think there are at least one or more key eyewitnesses who could have broken the case wide open if they shared everything they knew, but elected not to do so out of fear. And the big issue with that is that 42 years have now passed, and a number of the witnesses and key figures in this case have since passed away. Anyway, it's really difficult, if not outright impossible, to come up with a theory which does not involve John Cardona being complicit in Jay Givens' murder. We know that after being fired from the East Chicago PD, Cardona relocated to Florida, but his current whereabouts are unknown. We can't even be certain if Cardona is still alive, but if he is, he would be in his late 70s right now, and time is running out to charge him. This is not one of these cold cases in which DNA and forensic evidence will lead to an arrest, as it may require the right person coming forward with information. While the 42-year gap is definitely a disadvantage, the upside is that the passage of time may cause people to feel less fearful about speaking out. So if you happen to have any information about the murder of Jay Given, please contact the appropriate authorities. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Now, the reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. Over the past 5 years, our Patreon page has released dozens of exclusive bonus episodes, which are all currently available in our archives. This past month, I released an episode about the 1995 death of David Chase, which was featured on Unsolved Mysteries and supposedly involved a murder victim returning from the grave in order to provide information about how they were killed. I've also dropped an exclusive bonus episode from my spin-off podcast, The Path Went Chilly, in which myself and my two co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, discuss the unexplained 2002 death of Jamie Stickle. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries, and we now have over 50 of these commentary tracks in our archives. I'd also like to give a shout-out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Michael B., Kit C., and Jared K. Thank you so much for your support. Anyway, The Trail Went Cold will be appearing on Podcast Row at CrimeCon, which is being held from September the 22nd to the 24th at the World Center Marriott in Orlando, Florida. Our podcast has a specialized promo code which can be used to get a special 10% discount on tickets, so in order to do so, please visit CrimeCon.com and use the special promo code COOL23. That's COOL23. And in just 1 month, The Trail Went Cold will also be appearing at the True Crime Podcast Festival, which is taking place from August the 25th to the 27th at the DoubleTree by Hilton Hotel in Austin, Texas. We've got a specialized promo code which you can use in order to get a 15% discount on tickets, so if you would like to purchase them, please visit their website at truecrimepodcastfestival.com and use our promo code TRAIL. Once again, that's truecrimepodcastfestival.com and the promo code is TRAIL. I just wanted to give another shout-out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online Forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. So have yourselves a great week and join us next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold.